Accession number 10641, Rule 2.
Major Nagore, Rule 2.
And now they are buried in Yonkerbos War Cemetery at Nijmegen. My aircraft continued happily on its way, but we are still over England when suddenly the American crew chief, jump master, came down the aircraft and said, Lieutenant, we have a bit of a problem because one of your parachutes from the containers underneath the aircraft is developed. So, and it's difficult to fly. We had two containers underneath the aircraft with our spare machine guns and spare ammunition in them. So we went through a bizarre sort of pantomime with leaning out of the open door of the Dakota aircraft, looking at this parachute which was being shredded in the slipstream. And so I decided that we should jettison the container. So we pressed the button and the container dropped out of its bomb rack. But by that time the parachute had caught in something underneath the aircraft, and instead of losing the container, it swung in a delightful arc, and we then found we were towing the container free in the air behind us. This caused some consternation with the crew, the air crew, who said, well, we can't land and with that thing underneath. And I said, well, we can't jump because anyone jumping out would get their parachutes caught in this, all the stuff, gubbins flying along underneath. So we then tried to cut the container threads, strings, and a rifle and a bayonet were thrust out, and some chap leaned out and people leant on his legs and he leapt out in the slipstream, and we couldn't do it, and someone produced a broom which was a bit longer and they tied a bayonet to that, and none of this worked. So by this time the pilot said he had to drop out of formation, and we did. And we while well, we thought about this problem that we couldn't jump and they couldn't land. So finally it was decided we'd have to do a crash landing, so we got into crash landing positions and we landed on an adjacent airfield which turned out to be a flying fortress base. And we landed with a great crunch and crunch and ran along the runway with great crunching and bashing and so on, and we came happily and quietly to a stop. So we then all leapt out, jumped out, and my merry men cut the pieces of the parachute up and immediately used those for scarves and looked at the damage underneath the aircraft. And the pilot said, well, no way could he fly with the aircraft in that condition. It was battered and we were out of it. And we watched the tail end of the Armada sailing away towards Holland, and we didn't want to be left out of it. And we said, we've got to go because we couldn't miss this. And then fortunately some Flying Fortress engineers from, I suppose, 8th USAF came along in their jeep and with sledgehammers and things, and they were much tougher men than the pilot of our transport command aircraft, and they hammered away at the aircraft and they said that would be okay. Then the pilot produced, he said, well, of course I don't have a navigator. The navigator's in the lead ship, so I don't know the way. So he said, well, surely it's not that difficult. If we belt away, we can catch up with the Armada. And it turned out that he had been on the first drop the day before. And so after a lot of persuasion, we finally got back aboard again and took off.
Where was this place you crash landed, do you know?
It would have been South Yorkshire, I guess. It was somewhere somewhere in that area. And so we took off, and of course we were able to go faster being out of formation, and we eventually did see the formation ahead of us, and so we weren't lost. But the snag was that being the only aircraft in the sky, to some extent, we got all the flak that was available. And also, the fighter support, which had been supporting the main Armada, had tended to go home. So in the end, we were more or less sailing along alone some half an hour after, or something like that, some period after the rest of the day. And the other thing was that the pilot wasn't really, having lost his navigator, didn't know when to put the red light on and the green light on and so on. So finally we could see the DZ below us, although there was a lot of smoke on it, and we jumped out into a DZ which was partially burning, and unfortunately half the stick then dropped into the late, as it were, into the woods which were occupied by the Germans. And so when I got to battalion headquarters, I really only had about a half to a third of my platoon and only one machine gun instead of four and one or two reserves.
Do you know whereabouts this DZ was?
I think, in fact, it was DZY, but I would not be... couldn't accurately confirm that. We did manage to get a spare Vickers gun from the 1st Battalion, happily without their knowledge particularly, and we managed to get one or two spare men, so eventually I had a half platoon, really one section, with two guns, but very limited gun numbers and therefore limited ammunition.
What kind of spirits were you in at this time?
We were quite high spirits. I think we were a bit a bit worried about the slow progress we made to the different objectives that we were supposed to take. And there were already rumours flowing through that some of the things weren't going so well with the brigade which had dropped the day before. But basically the men were all in good spirits.
What did the DZ look like?
The DZ was burning. It was thick gorse, and I suppose mortar bombs or smoke bombs landing into that. Some people said the Germans set it on fire, I don't know. But somehow or other, large parts of the DZ were burning and were under fire. There were pockets of Germans all around the DZ. I was hit by a bullet as I lay after I landed. I stood up and promptly got hit on the right thigh. Fortunately, it didn't penetrate. It hit my mat case, which was there, and went through my trousers, and all I got was a mild scratch. But there was one officer who was hit through both legs, one of our rifle platoon commanders, and found himself surrounded by burning gorse and shot himself, and because he didn't want to obviously be burnt to death.
Were there many casualties about in the DZ?
Yes, I don't know many. One saw the occasional chap being carted off and that sort of thing. I don't think it was any worse than one would have expected. But remember, I was a bit flustered trying to get my own platoon together, having lost half my men in one aircraft and a good third in my own aircraft, some of whom joined us after hair-raising experiences with the Germans in the woods, and some who I never saw again.
How ferocious was the German opposition at that time?
It varied. At that time, I don't think it was very heavy. I mean, they were basically troops of a lower calibre, and generally it varied. But within the next 24 hours, when we started to meet the SS people, it changed considerably.
So, can you tell me more in detail about the movement that you made from the DZ?
Well, of course, our role was to move along the northern flank. Our brigade, 4th Parabrigade, was to hold the northern approaches to the town of Arnhem. The 1st Brigade having gone to the bridge and the inner part of Arnhem. As we arrived, one of our battalions, the 11th Battalion, was taken away because already the 1st Brigade was in trouble. I don't think the Brigadier really wanted that to happen, that particular battalion, if he'd been given the choice. But anyway, the two battalions, 10th Battalion and 156, pushed on. We were halted that night. Things went very slowly. That was one of the results of A, having taken off late, and B, the distance we were from Arnhem itself. And so it was nightfall very quickly, and we halted that night, which gave the Germans time to consolidate, which they did very rapidly and very brilliantly, in my humble opinion. And so although one of our companies was in action that night, It wasn't really till the next morning that we really branched out and pushed on again and met heavy opposition all that day, and in fact never got through that opposition. A Company put in an attack and lost virtually two platoons. B Company lost a platoon. C Company lost one or two platoons. And by the end of the second day, the battalion was very weak.
Were there any civilians about?
Yes. Quite a lot of civilians, Dutch civilians, who had come out to the DZ to welcome us and waving Dutch flags and very helpful and giving drinks of water and wine and so on. Very, very friendly, very, very helpful. A number of them put on orange armbands and turned out to be resistance workers and tried to join us. Dutch nurses everywhere. It was, the Dutch population were very, very good.
Did you ever come across what might be described as a Dutch fifth column or suspected Dutch fifth column?
Not me. I didn't. No.
What happened on the third day?
The third day was a bit of a catastrophe for 4th Parachute Brigade because by mid-afternoon we were in held up in some woods, and there was a resupply glider reinforcements coming in, and as they started to arrive we received dramatic orders to withdraw within the next 15 minutes back down to the railway line and along back towards where the DZs had been to Wolfhazer Crossroads. There was only 15 minutes, and there was where at the same time there was a German attack coming in, and we had already been strafed, incidentally, by German aircraft, which rather took everybody by surprise, since, in our humble opinion at that time, they didn't exist, but they did strafe us. And so we went back, and in some confusion, we got to the railway line. We were under attack from Germans. It was really quite a rabble, almost. It was difficult to get the anti-tank guns across the railway line. The Poles were arriving in their gliders, the Polish reinforcements, some Polish reinforcements in their gliders simultaneously. And we got back to the railway line, I with my men and the rest of support company, the remains of B Company and some men of C Company did get back to the railway crossing where we were supposed to be, Wolfhazer. But battalion headquarters and the rest of the survivors only got to within about 500 yards of the railway crossing. But they had brigade headquarters with them, and they, for some reason, which I've never understood, decided to stay there. So we were already split up as a battalion. We sheltered in Wolfhazer all night, took up a defensive position there and so on, with the remnants of 10th Battalion. At dawn, a dawn attack came in with Tiger tanks and all sorts of SS and
SS,
and we were told that, in fact, the OCB Company said, right, abandon the position, every man for himself, and we scattered into the woods at that stage. And at that point of time, we did not know that a perimeter had been formed. We had, I, for example, and I managed to gather about 20 men with me of different all sorts of units, mainly parachutists. We got away down between the houses. We clambered over the fences of and hedges of houses, with the Germans shooting down between the houses and occupying some of the houses. We had a mad scramble down, and we got to the end and into the woods. But we didn't know of the existence of a perimeter as such at that time. We had no idea what was happening. Or where the rest of the people were at all. And we decided to, we lay low for a bit to see if any more people would come, which they didn't, and we decided, one or two stragglers turned up, and decided to make for the river, which we thought would be the best thing. But at that moment, a company of the King's Own Scottish Borderers came through the woods, complete, and they had been guarding the DZs, and they had not met the enemy by some fluke although some of their other companies had been in heavy action, and they were complete. And so I put myself under command of the company commander, and my scratch force acted as the sort of scouts, and we continued towards the river. But we very soon ran into German opposition. We were completely surrounded, came under fire and one thing or another, and the company commander decided to surrender his whole company. I personally didn't agree with that, and took to the woods again with some of my parachutists, and but they surrendered, and probably it was the right decision at the time, because some 130 men lived to see the end of the war, whereas if we'd fought it out, slogged it out at that time, most of them probably wouldn't, and I don't think it would have affected the Battle of Arnhem, or because we were completely isolated, and it wouldn't have had any impact on anything at all, I don't think. But however, whatever the rights or wrongs of it, after 40 years it is irrelevant. I took to the woods. I was subsequently wounded slightly, and taken prisoner.
How did your capture occur? Can you describe it?
Yes. I wasn't able to see very well because I got a lot of stuff. An explosion had taken place on and in front of me, and I got a lot of stuff in my eyes, and I wasn't quite sure if it was sand or muck or rubble or what. In fact, it was, I guess, dust or shock, but at the time I couldn't see very well, and my batman had stayed with me, Private McCarthy, and we were surrounded, and he said, right, this is it, and we were in German hands.
What did you feel about the performance of your men at Arnhem?
Oh, I think that they were very good. Their morale was always quite high, and under different circumstances they'd have put up one hell of a fight, as did the 2nd Battalion on the bridge, or the men later on in the perimeters. There was no question that if we had had time to consolidate and get into a position and get formed up and then do things, the men were very good indeed. And even under the circumstances of when they were overrun or scattered in the woods and they had no officers or NCOs with them, most of them individually continued to evade capture and even continued to fight and so on. The men were, in my opinion, very good indeed. As it happens, in my own platoon there are 4 survivors plus myself, one of whom, Eggleton, who lives in Hull, was the only one to get back across the river at that time, and the rest of us were wounded and prisoner. One now lives in New Zealand and 2 live in the Potteries, and we have remained in contact and still write regularly and meet each other whenever we can.
What was your first sight of the German captors at close up? What kind of impression did they make?
Well, I couldn't see them properly. My impression was that they were basically young. They looked fairly well organised. I suspect they were the NCO Kader of the armoured Panzer division, which was there. But they were quite well disciplined, they looked quite well armed, and they didn't look as though they felt they were on the losing side, which we thought they felt they should have been.
What was their demeanour towards you?
The frontline troops were really quite pleasant, and there was no problems at all. Further back, when you started to meet LFC people, they, as I think is true in all armies, they sometimes were a bit difficult, but there was such a mass of us after Arnhem. I mean, it wasn't as though we had been captured in a small company affair and we were one or two prisoners on our own. We were rapidly concentrated at Apeldoorn and put on a train into Germany, and so there were really, you know, large masses of prisoners, and an old saying, safety in numbers, I guess.
It interests me that so many people tell me that there is this almost fellow feeling between frontline troops on opposite sides. Is it too strong to say that?
I think so. I think it depends entirely on the circumstances. But I know there were stories of the 1st Parachute Brigade in North Africa who were captured or wounded and were almost rescued from being shot by fellow German parachutists and so on. I think it has existed in all wars. In periods of quiet, one hears of, you know, let's keep it quiet, we don't want to cause any trouble either of us, and so on. I know it certainly existed in the First World War, my father told me often. And yes, I think there is a great deal. And of course, after the war now, there's a lot of communication after 20-30 years between German parachutists and British parachutists and the French parachutists and so on.
Is that a fellow feeling because you're both specialists?
Some part of it, I think, may be this myth of parachuting. I think it probably, and this is only my feeling and I really have no facts whatsoever to back it up, I think it is stronger with the world of parachutists than perhaps with ordinary infantry or other arms. It may also be the same between, for example, air crew and submarine crews and so on. I don't know. But that's my feeling.
What kind of problems come when you meet line of communications troops?
Well, they're first of all, they're insensitive to some extent, and they're probably a bit frightened themselves, and one thing or another. I mean, I think we see it in our own armies that people behind the lines, the prison guards, or are usually set lower quality sort of troops, and therefore lower quality sort of people, and therefore you meet lower quality reaction.
In terms of theft or violence or what?
Oh, theft. Well, both, I suppose. But theft, I think the frontline troops often relieve you of watches and interest in souvenirs and so on. And I think that's typical of all soldiers.
Did the German troops ever use the term front swine?
Not that I know of, no. I think there was a lot of feeling against RAF personnel, particularly. I don't know if we have time, but there is a rather amusing story that of a Flight Sergeant King, George King, who was really an ex-air gunner, but found himself as a dispatcher on the resupply aircraft, Dakota aircraft. And he was in one of the resupply squadrons, but he wasn't on duty this particular day, but somebody suddenly went sick, and he was going to meet his wife in whichever village they were stationed to go to the cinema at 7 o'clock at night. And so as their takeoff was during the late morning, and he thought they'd be back for an easy trip to Arnhem and back, he didn't bother to do anything about it, and he was a reserve member of this crew and so on. And so they happily took off, but over Arnhem they got hit. The engines caught fire. He was busily dispatching packages and containers through, and as the last one went down the aircraft, the pilot said, "Abandon aircraft," or called out over the intercom, "Abandon aircraft." So he followed it down and went out through the door. The problem was that he hadn't got his parachute fitted, which was an aircraft, air crew type parachute, but it was hanging by the door. So as he went out through the door, he got his arms through it. He went out through the door with his parachute harness half on and half off, and of course they weren't very high. He got caught in the slipstream, and his shoes were whipped off him. He'd only got civilian type shoes on, and they were whipped off him in the slipstream. And so he came down, not from a very great height, buckling his parachute up as he came. As he was wearing, as he landed quite hardly, as he wasn't properly in his wife. And he landed with, hurt himself quite a bit, but only bruises, but halfway between where the Germans were and the British were. As he was wearing a grey sort of uniform, the British fired at him every time he moved, thinking he was a German. And the Germans who'd seen him coming down fired at him every time he moved as well. So he lay between the two lines all the evening, that night, being shot at by whenever he moved, and worrying about his poor wife waiting for him in the cinema at back at base. During the night, a British patrol came past, and they picked him up and said, well, we've got to do whatever we've got to do, tag on behind. And they gave him a Sten gun, and he tagged along behind this British patrol moving through the night. And they found a dead German with some boots on him, and they gave him these boots, which didn't fit terribly well, but he staggered along behind. And the patrol got back to the British lines just as dawn broke out, whereupon the Germans put in a dawn attack and overran the position. And there was he, wearing German jack boots, in RAF uniform, captured. And they gave him a rough time because of the terror bombing and all the terror fliegen and all this sort of thing. But they said that in Arnhem the day before, some unexploded bombs had been dropped. And they lined them up, and they took an artillery captain, and he, because he was in RAF uniform, wearing wings, and said, you must be bomb experts. And he and this captain had to go into Arnhem, and neither of them knowing anything about bombs, and the bombs were sort of sticking half in and half out of the dirt. And they didn't know what to do about them, so they eventually dug them out and rolled them down into the Rhine and so on. And when I met him, which was two or three days later, he said, my God, you know, all these 24 hours, this has all happened to me, and my poor wife still waiting in the cinema queue. So I think RAF people could have a rougher time because of the terror bombing.
Once you and your men were captured, what was the morale like?
Well, I wasn't with my own men by that time. We were all scattered. I mean, there were only four of us anyway, and we'd all got lost in the woods. But the people I was with, on the whole, I think it was quite good. Officers were separated, mark you. So it was an officer type thing. One chap managed to get away off the train. One of my friends, who'd been wounded during the battle, Mike Cambier, was wounded in the ankle, recovered, escaped, was caught by the German SS or German Gestapo and put against the wall and shot, together with another officer of another parachute regiment. We found out where that is, and we found out that the SS man who did it was captured by the Dutch civilians at the end of the war and was then court-martialed and in his turn hung. But generally, morale was on the whole quite high. I can tell you of John Potts, who was the company commander of our Able company, who was badly wounded, was in the leg, was taken into a hospital just inside Germany, and in spite of being on crutches and in British uniform, climbed out of a window of the hospital and went down.